Group meeting, Saturday, 16th January 1982. This is the question which was asked. Should one wait till one has sorted oneself out spiritually before joining in doing good works? I'll read the question again. Should one wait till one has sorted oneself out spiritually before joining in good works? Now, I think that's a very good question. The questioner is obviously someone who has perception and sensitivity, and who means business and is serious-minded. And in order to explore this question, we will have to ask ourselves several other questions too, which arise out of it. First, why do we want to do good works? One may say it is because it gives one pleasure. But if the pleasure drive is a factor in wanting to do a good work, by joining others who are doing that particular work, then if the others have as I was saying, if the others who are involved in the work have different views of how to do the work and so on, there will be conflict and there will be displeasure. And then that is not going to help the good work as such. It will spoil it, obviously. So we have to examine ourselves and see whether it is the pleasure drive in us which is responsible in some degree or other for our desire to join in doing good works. Then there is the other aspect, another aspect, personal interest. We are interested in the matter. All right? We are interested in it. But is this an element of self-interest or is it a disinterested interest? If it is a disinterested interest, it is likely to be truly altruistic. But if it is not, and it takes more or less a perfected one to have that kind of disinterested interest, a true altruism about him, which functions naturally and spontaneously. If we are not one like that, then our personal interest will again introduce the element of self-interest. We are interested in ourselves. We are identifying ourselves with the good work. And any element of selfness in any shape and form, and especially the subtle aspects of selfness, always spoil good works as such. So we have to make sure that we haven't got a personal self-interested attitude towards the good work which we want to join in. Then, of course, there is the obvious ego satisfaction which is involved. I am doing something good. And that is an extraordinary illusion from which all mankind suffers. There is only one doer, and that is transcendence itself. It is the one total reality which is the real doer. Each one of us, every situation, everything that happens throughout the universe is an apparatus through which transcendence functions. Now we don't bear that in mind, especially if we are somewhat extrovert, go ahead, get on with the job type. We never think of these things. So that when we don't think of these things, our natural self-orientedness steps in, and we do it not as unto the Supreme, but as unto ourselves. So we get a marvelous ego fillip in attempting to do that good work. So we have to be very careful about the ego satisfaction aspect, which is associated with power gratification. We all have power lust in some degree or other, in some form or other. I know in my own personal life, in my young years, I had a tremendous power lust. I wanted to do this, that, and the other, which was good for mankind, and I was going to do it and derive great satisfaction from it. And it was all nonsense. And life was very kind. It hurt me hard enough to teach me. Well, that of course involves the aspect of dominating the social group which is concerned with that good work as such. Then there is the other situation. There are those who cannot help doing good. But such people are rather rare in the world. They just cannot refrain from doing good. And generally speaking, they don't know that they are doing good. Goodness is something which radiates from one. Like heat and light radiate from the sun. Like love radiates from one who is truly loving by nature. So, if there's such a person, then he can certainly join in doing good work, and his activity will probably produce the least bit of harm. We do so much which we consider good without seeing ahead and recognizing that there can be all sorts of troublesome problems arising out of the doing good. Take dear old Hippocrates, the father of medicine, and the oath to alleviate suffering wheresoever and whensoever it is possible, in every case. And in our own day and age, prolonging life has become a craze almost. Prolong life. Look at the suffering that some of the very, very old ones go through. They are not allowed to die. They'd be much better off if they were not alive. They have to suffer so much, and they are kept alive. There are some honest doctors and surgeons who say, well, they are a good field for investigation which could help others. Yes, at the expense of suffering for this person. One has to consider those things. And prolonging life has brought into existence many other problems. Look at the way in which old people like me are a burden on the state. The state gives me a pension. True, it's not enough to take me to the Costa Brava, but but it does keep body and soul together, or at least partly together, and so on. But it is a burden upon the state. And there are many other things which are associated with the mere prolongation of life. And we'll consider one rather important aspect of that in a moment or two. But if there is real compassion for the suffering of others, then one is likely to be quite useful in joining a group or whatever it is in doing good work. But the person who has real compassion for others can be doing good all along the line, all the time that he's alive. Take for instance this extraordinary event over that air crash near Washington. That man who jumped into that ice-cold water, swam out, saved the life of that lady. I mean, he just did it like that. He need not have done it, but the natural compassion functioning right inside him made him jump into the ice-cold water and drag her to safety. Things like that happen. And then, of course, that's quite different. And he did it without joining any group which has set out to do good. He happened to be there. There was the situation which called for that act. And he performed it at once, just like that. Now, the second great point, question which arises, we have been trying to consider, why do we want to do good works? The second question is, have we real understanding and ability to do the good work? We know quite well that in the modern world, so many people join this, that, or the other group which is concerned with doing good work. They are actually getting on the bandwagon. It brings in money or kudos or whatever it is. I don't mean the detergent, but kudos, but kudos in the sense of appreciation and all the rest of it, you see. So now, we must inquire, have we real understanding and ability to do the good work? And this is tied up with the very important question, what is the good? We talked about the prolongation of life, arbitrarily affirmed as essentially good in itself. But is it? It produces so many other problems. If we understood what was the good, we would know better. In fact, we would refrain from rushing about trying to do good. We all know how the do-gooders pester the world all the time. They are rushing about, compelling you to join this society or that society, which is doing so much good to the country, to the people, and this, that, and the other. And if they can extract £10 or 100 or better still 1,000 or 10,000 out of you, well, then you have done great good. Have you? One has to consider these things very, very carefully. There are so many factors involved, subtle psychological factors, so subtle that their ill effects remain invisible for quite a long time. Take one case. concerning the curing of illness. Of course, wheresoever one sees illness or suffering or in any shape or form, it is natural, it is right, it is proper to help as much as we possibly can help in the matter. There is no question about that. There is no question in such a situation of waiting until we are spiritually sorted out before doing the good work. We do it, we have to do it at once. But take a case like this. During the First World War, Hitler was blinded by chlorine. You know, they used poison gas during the First World War. A very skillful doctor cured him of that, put him into circulation in society again. What happened? Six million Jews slaughtered. A world in ruins. And the world is finding it so hard to recover from the harm done. We all know that. We all see that. We see degeneration, breakdown, unreliability, inefficiency, appalling violence, self-centeredness, inconsiderateness, all along the line in every country in the world. Not only those who fought and suffered in the last war, the Second World War, but the whole world is getting engulfed in this thing, in this evil. That one of the main sources of that was curing Hitler, wasn't it? Or am I wrong? Now, this does not mean that if a person is blinded in some way or by some means or other, he should not be healed. It is, of course, the doctor's duty to do his best to heal that person. All right. But there is something deeper. A doctor, the conventional doctor, is concerned with getting rid of the symptoms and getting the physical body right and working again. But true healing is the healing of the whole person. Now, supposing some doctor in Nazi Germany, well, not in Nazi Germany, in pre-Nazi Germany, this is after the First World War, supposing some doctor had been able to heal Hitler, not only physically, but in his whole soul, what a power he could have been for good. With that tremendous drive and energy, he might have been, the whole world might have been different if that could have been done. But you see, when the good happens to be something fragmentary, that fragment is cut out, taken out of the context of the whole, and because it is taken out of the context of the whole, it is usually, perhaps always, in conflict with the whole as such. These are very deep matters. You will find one extraordinary difference when you read the lives of the great spiritual teachers and the founders of the religions. In the case of Jesus, there is great emphasis laid upon his healing powers. That he healed this, he healed the other, and so forth. And in fact, he became so famous because of his healing that the multitudes gathered. And what did he do? When he saw the multitudes wanting healing, it is said in the beginning of the 5th chapter of St. Matthew, he went up into a mountain. And when he had set himself there, his disciples, his chosen disciples, came unto him. And then he started speaking. Now what did he tell the people? The whole of the Sermon on the Mount follows, chapters 5 and 6. Now if you look at the opening part of chapter 5, blessed are they, etc., etc., all those items, he is talking about the true fulfillment and well-being of any human being. That is what he is actually talking of. And he's talking of it from a transcendent level. They call it the Sermon on the Mount. I far prefer to call it the Sermon from the Mount. I mean, just imagine, here are multitudes who had assembled. And Jesus goes up into, take it literally first, he goes up into a mountain and only his chosen disciples follow him. What was there to prevent the multitudes following? But they didn't. What is this mountain into which he went? Is it not, perhaps, this mountain here, this mount, the Sahasrara Chakra, which is associated with the entry into the supreme meditative condition, where what he said about himself, I and the Father are one, is actually functioning there and then through him. That state. And in that state, he gives out the Beatitudes and all the moral teachings which he gives afterwards. And they are all aimed, if you look at the whole thing very carefully, at healing the whole man. And Jesus knows, as all great spiritual teachers know, that the true healing has to come out of the living man himself. If I am ill, the true healing has to come out of me myself. I can be assisted by the physical skill of another, or the psychological perception and skill of another. I can be helped. But the actual healing has to come out of me myself. Now Jesus knew that. Now you take the case of the Buddha. He didn't do anything like that. All these miraculous healings, the blind and the lame and so on. In the Rig Veda, you get the original statement, he heals the blind see, the lame walk, and so on. I'm sorry, I've forgotten the exact reference, but I've quoted it in my first book. It's one of the hymns to the god Soma. Soma is the god of inspiration, of a profound insight, and so on. You see, and it is in one of those hymns. You take the case of the Buddha. What does he do? Or what does he do when he sends his foremost disciples? They ask the person who is suffering from illness, certain questions. Of course, they first inquire, how are you getting on? Are your pains increasing or decreasing? And they always say, Lord, my pains are increasing, and so forth, you see. Then the question comes, what do you think of this, John Smith or whoever is the monk to whom he is talking? What do you think of this? Is body permanent or impermanent? And the answer, of course, is impermanent, Lord. Now, is that which is impermanent anything but painful, soulless, and liable to death, of course, you see? And the monk answers in the affirmative, yes, it is so. Then, is it right to say of the body, this is mine, this am I, this is the ultimate transcendent in me? Atta in Pali is the equivalent of the Sanskrit Atma, Atma. And of course, the answer is that no, one can't consider it that way. Therefore, says the Buddha, or his great disciples, don't cling to body. Let be, and let things take their course. And the same is repeated for feelings, thoughts, one's character pattern, ideas, beliefs, and so on, and for discriminative consciousness itself. They are all perishing. They are impermanent, they are anatta, they have no ultimate soul or whatever it is in them, you see. So let them go. Now we think, of course, that this is just a conversation. It is not just a conversation. When people of the caliber of the perfected holy ones talk to you or to me, they are capable of putting us into a totally different mode of awareness. Our whole understanding is completely transformed. We see with unerring insight the fact of the matter. And in that state of consciousness, if there is to be a healing according to one's karma, as they used to say, then you will be healed. If there is not to be a healing, then you will pass away. But you will pass away liberated. Now these are things which in our modern world, and especially in what we commonly call the developed countries of the world, these are not very agreeable or acceptable teachings. But there is something to meditate upon very, very carefully. This is what happens, you see. So, coming back to this business of have we real understanding and the ability to do good work. There is in this connection what we may call the long-term situation. For example, the sad and unnecessary slaughter on a colossal scale that goes on in the world. For food, for instance. People shrug their shoulders and say, well, I don't kill the animal. All right, I don't kill the animal, but the animal is killed for me. If there wasn't a demand from me, that murder of a living creature would not take place. That is the point. Besides, it makes us insensitive if we do not consider this matter carefully. Compassion's demand is that one lives and let live. Let's live. Then there is the extraordinary amount of killing which is done for sport. How human beings can go about slaying animals, harmless animals who have done them no harm, who have done the hunter no harm whatsoever, how they can go about shooting it and experiencing delight from it. And then proudly showing off the tiger skin shot in Nepal, in wherever it may be, you see, or the rhinoceros horn which he plucked out of the face of the rhinoceros. He was so strong and so brave, you see, and all that sort of nonsense and rubbish. Sheer egoism, sheer vanity, sheer inhumanity. And then again, in a lesser degree, there is carelessness, which brings about slaughter. I am told that there is an unbelievable number of deaths by being run over by a car taking place every day in the big cities of the world. Every day. It's extraordinary, isn't it? But that's carelessness. Admittedly, it's not the carelessness of the driver of the car every time. Occasionally there's a person like me who is so involved in plain living and high thinking that he doesn't look and just steps out into the road precisely when a car is coming at 50-60 miles an hour or whatever it is. And of course he gets run over, and serve him right too for being such a jaywalker. It's so inconsiderate to the person who is driving the car not to be careful about it and step in front of him. Then again, as far as the long-term situation is concerned, there is the question of ecology. We have plundered the earth terribly now for centuries. Why? In order, first and foremost, to make wealth. The oil magnate, the steel magnate, and so on and so on. Without consideration for the earth, the plants, and the animals who are all involved in the process. We have heartlessly disemboweled parts of Mother Earth without thinking of the consequences. And now scientists and others who have woken up to the fact, are doing their utmost to try and stop this terrible exploitation of the earth and its creatures and plants and so forth. All to satisfy one's greed and vanity, power lust, egoism, and so forth. We may now ask, is it wiser then to be quiet and watchful and act as the situation or person needs or demands? If we can be quiet, we will have real insight into the whole situation. We'll see clearly for ourselves what sort of response we should make to the doing of this, that or the other good work as such. We must see whether there's any self-centered element of personal gain involved in any form, whether it be possessions, goods, authority, status, money, etc. We have to be very watchful of that, because all these elements play their part in spoiling the little good that we might be able to do. And we've got to be watchful. If we cultivate mindfulness, practice mindfulness all day, every day, very carefully, we will be amazed to discover the number of situations which arise in little ways, which are opportunities for doing good in the real sense. And then it is done at once, on the spot. It is done naturally, spontaneously. And that good is free of any sort of taint in it, which would bring about unpleasant results later on. These things really are very deep. But as we saw before, there are situations in which one can't wait to weigh up the pros and the cons and the possible future consequences and all the rest of it. One just acts at once. You see a little toddler on the pavement just straying away from its parent and walking into the middle of the street. You catch hold of the little idiot and pull him back at once. And that's that. That's another matter altogether. There are situations which require immediate action. There are, and all the other situations require very deep consideration and perception, clear perception of what is involved in this good work which is being done. Take one curious thing which happens in our lives. I think perhaps every one of us has suffered from it. Receiving gratuitous advice. And you know what that is like. And the sort of person who just will not stop chattering and pours out this advice, that advice, practically compels you to do this, that or the other thing. Haven't we all suffered from gratuitous advice? I have, in my lifetime. Now, we come to the main question as such, sorting oneself out spiritually. We have touched upon several points like compassion and understanding and so on. This is the sorting oneself out spiritually. its root, perhaps, is careful, true observation. If we observe very carefully, then we shall be able to see what are the elements in ourself which would spoil the good that we do. And that way, this spiritual development takes place inside. If and when one is the perfected Holy One, then there is no problem at all. But for all of us, it is a problem, this spiritual sorting out. And one of the, and perhaps the most important point in this connection is that we must let it happen. Our greed to become good, capable, perfect, and so forth is so awful. We have a real greed that way, but we don't observe it, that it spoils whatever possible good we may do. We have to let the good happen. Let the healing within ourselves take place, assisted by good sense on our part and right action, insofar as we can produce right action in our finite, temporal, mortal state. When you let the thing happen, you draw upon the store of transcendent energy. This is yoga, the real yoga. And when you draw upon that source of transcendent energy, it will guide you infallibly. One may say that, oh yes, I prayed to the Lord and the Lord answered thus and guided me thus, but all I experienced was so much disappointment and pain and so forth. That can happen, of course. But if transcendence delivers pain, that pain is the right thing in that particular situation for him who would do good, because he learns thereby. Treat this, or rather look upon this sorting out oneself spiritually as a gift of transcendence. To use theistic language, it happens by God's grace. Doesn't happen because I did this, that, and the other. I'm only like the caretaker of the temple who sweeps the temple clean. That is all. You see? Nothing else. And if I can live like that all through the day, then my burden is dropped. The doer, the real doer, the totality, transcendence itself, comes into operation. These are not just words or just ideas. One experiences these things and sees them actually happening in one's life. It is I myself who am blockhead enough to obstruct the light of transcendence from enlightening me. This is something which we have to recognize and fully acknowledge to ourselves. If we can acknowledge it fully to ourselves, it means that the impurities in our inner consciousness are all dissolved and they are out of the situation. And then the right thing happens. It will happen naturally and spontaneously, unspoiled by my ideas or wishes or ambitions or desires in any shape or form. The saint, the true saint, is the person who unknowingly does good all the time. And the greatest good that he does is that he is a center which radiates all that is beneficial for man, for his own situation and for the environment in which he lives. then that is a situation where one is really living the godly life, the religious life, in the profound sense of the word.